There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Professional wrestling, like real life, is full of surprises. Hi, everyone. It's Freddie Prinze Jr. And it's no surprise I can talk wrestling all day, any day. Kind of like how State Farm agents can talk insurance and help you choose the right coverage. When it comes to important insurance decisions, let State Farm support you with the coverage you need, backed with 24/7 support. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hello, everyone. I'm Wilmer Valderrama.
And I'm MR Raquel. This is Essential Voices.
I remember one time on the show, I asked you how you were, and you were like, the weather has been so nice here in Oakland. It's been raining, and there's grass. You were so happy about the green grass. But I totally understood what you mean, because rain, and therefore grass, is rare here in California. What's happening up in the Bay Area right now?
It's funny you say that, because I was just out at a hiking spot in the Oakland and Berkeley Hills, and I was thinking that even though the hills look green-ish, they're definitely starting to look a little drier every day, and we could definitely use some more rain. On top of that, it was just a little while back when we had smoky air after the devastating Big Sur fire, not to mention that 2021's fire season was one of the worst on record. In the Bay, it's like we went from an awful fire season to extreme rains and now spring? It's hard to catch up. But I can't even imagine dealing with all of this if I were a firefighter.
Did you just say firefighter?
I did.
Get out of my head, MR. You know, I guess you were reading my mind. But no, seriously, I can't believe you just went there, because this week we're focusing on firefighting during the pandemic, during some of California's worst fire seasons to date. But we like to shake things up here on Essential Voices. So while we are most definitely speaking with a badass firefighter today, we had the true honor of speaking to a particular firefighter who's experienced this work from multiple perspectives and from within multiple places, and who's emerged from the experiences with serving in his community and his heart.
That's absolutely right. When we were putting this episode together, we recognized that although most California residents are affected by the weeks of smoke hanging in the air, and for some, the brutal loss of family homes due to rampant fires, the history behind who's fighting fires on the front lines and why this labor is called upon can be slightly murky. So we wanted to, in a small way, help uncover some of California's sketchier infrastructure by highlighting a firefighter today, Gabriel, who was formerly incarcerated and is an expertly trained firefighter. Gabriel was working every day within the California fire camps, and he's no longer incarcerated, and we had the honor of speaking to him to hear what his experience was like during his firefighting career while he was incarcerated, and how his firefighting career has continued to develop now that he's no longer incarcerated. Gabriel has also gone through an incredible program called the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program, which supports formerly incarcerated firefighters in a multitude of ways, which we'll have the opportunity to hear more about in our roundtable conversation.
Thank you, MR. And that's right. So after our conversation with Gabriel, we'll have a roundtable discussion with author and journalist Jamie Lowe, who wrote the book Breathing Fire, which documents the stories of firefighters on the front lines who are women and who are incarcerated, along with Brandon Smith, who is the founder of the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program, which provides support to formerly incarcerated firefighters, along with those currently working in the California fire camps.
We have some amazing stories coming up for you.
We most certainly do. So let's get it. Gabriel's story starts right now.
Hi, my name is Gabriel Perez. I'm calling from San Bernardino, California, and I am a firefighter.
Gabriel, thank you so much for being here with us today. I'm really excited for this conversation. And so to get started, tell me about who you are and what you do.
Well, I do firefighting, and I'm trying to advance my career and get up next levels, you know. I just basically just got out of prison, just trying to get on the right path, stay on the right path, and try to serve my community and be an asset and learn as much as I could while I'm here.
That's amazing. And you just mentioned that you're a firefighter and that also you were incarcerated. So is firefighting something that you learned to do while you were incarcerated?
Absolutely. I never, ever thought that I would be a firefighter. I never imagined it. But because of the things that happened in prison, I got sent to fire camp. And as I was there and started picking up the work aspect of it and the physical capabilities of it, it's something that I learned to enjoy. And as I got more into it, it became a passion of mine. And it's something that I hope to do for a long time, as long as I'm able to.
That's so awesome that you learned to enjoy the work and that you became passionate about it, too. So can you describe what the camps are and why they exist within the prison industrial complex? And maybe also what drives the passion that you have for firefighting?
So I feel like the camps is something that you have to earn while you're in prison. It comes along with good behavior. And as your levels drop, then you're able to take part in the camp. And the camp I was at was very physical. It was a lot of physical activity. So it was rough kind of when I first got there. I had a hard time keeping up with it. As I continued to get better, get in better shape, I started to like it. And I seen a lot of guys that were coming in poor shape, getting in good shape, and then started to enjoy it also. But I feel like it's all about perspective. You know, I could have went there and like, man, I hate this. I don't ever want to do this again in my life. I can't wait to get out. Or I can learn from it and make something of it and make a career out of it. And then that turned into something like, man, I really enjoy this. I feel like it's more of a calling, you know, like I feel like I was placed there. It was part of my purpose in life, you know, and I'm trying to, as far as that goes, hopefully to see what it leads to, you know, because a lot of other doors opened up as well, you know, for me being there. So I don't look at it as a bad thing at all. I feel very fortunate and blessed to be able to take part in that.
Wow, Gabriel, thank you so much for giving me a deeper understanding of a little bit of your journey within the fire camps. I can really see why you feel like this work is a calling. And you said that getting sent to the fire camps is kind of like a reward for good behavior. Do folks have a choice about whether or not they go to the fire camps?
You kind of do. When they first told me that I was going to be going there, I didn't want to go at all. You know, I was comfortable where I was at and I just wanted to do the rest of my time. But it was a reward because I still had 5 years left on my sentence. I wasn't supposed to be home till 2024, you know, and because of me going there, it knocked off a lot of years off my sentence. So I was comfortable where I was at, but I'm even better now. So it kind of was a sacrifice, you know, that I had to make.
That's a beautiful perspective. And, you know, I can imagine that you show up in the camps having never thought that you'd ever be a firefighter, right? But that even as a beginner, you definitely want to make sure that you take all of the safety precautions and know exactly what you're doing, because then all of a sudden you're tasked with being out on the front lines. So how did the camps prepare you or train you for your firefighting duties?
So you take like a 2-week course before you get to your actual camp, and you learn your basic S-190, your basic introduction to fire behavior. And then we watch a lot of videos about like tragedy stories, you know, to see like, man, it's real out there. You know, it's not just no game out there. People have lost their lives out there. So you learn from unfortunate situations that happen, and you got to have your head on a swivel. They say like always got to have your situational awareness up, because we've been close to the fire where the fire's coming towards us and we had to run, you know, that's how real it was. So, I mean, I took it like kind of seriously, and I still take it seriously to this day, you know, and you never stop learning out there. Like it's always something more to learn, always something more to get better at.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of information you have to make sure you're paying attention to stay safe out there. So how does the training that you received inside the camps compare to training that you've gone through now that you're no longer incarcerated? You know, are there similarities? Are there differences? And is there any additional training you've received recently or that you'd like to receive?
So yeah, out there, you're just a tool. The captain does all the thinking and we're just expected to do the work, you know? Out here, it's a little more different. We got to actually think individually for ourselves, for our team, you know? I was on the Caldor fire, which was a pretty big fire up north. Being out there, placed with more responsibility on myself, I had to start thinking like, hold on, now I got to start looking around, watch for certain things that I've been listening, but I never had to actually think for myself as far as being in camp. So it's a more responsibility. Also, there's more we can do out here. Like I have a phone where I could Google stuff now. You know, if I want to watch all these videos or go onto the websites that teach this stuff and take courses, I'm able to now and get some more experience. You know, I've received some medical training and I hope to advance that. I want to get my EMT next and then see where I go after that, because that will help me be of more service to my community.
That's beautiful. And it sounds like you kind of transitioned from following what the captain was teaching you to getting more comfortable with the work and really making decisions for yourself, which is amazing. And it's great that you know that you want to pursue your EMT training next. And given that you've been through lots of training already, both while incarcerated and now that you're no longer incarcerated, what's a typical day like for you in your current position?
For me right now, I work for a fuels reduction crew, so basically, right now, what we do is we just create defensible space for homes to keep them fire safe. We go out every day and we scout properties that need that defensible space. And we're cutting trees down. We're cleaning up the yard, you know. I also volunteer for a station up north. And there where I got a little bit more station experience to where we're just basically doing the typical stuff you see, you know, as far as like riding in the engines, going to medical calls, stuff like that. And I'm currently taking an academy to where I'll be able to learn like the structure part of firefighting so I can do that next season.
That's awesome. And folks are fortunate that you're out there keeping their houses safe. And it sounds like since you're still actively pursuing other kinds of training, like you mentioned, I'm wondering if you have any mentors or team members who have shaped your experience throughout your training.
I think I took a little bit from every person out there. Every person, when I first started this journey, I seen a lot of great qualities and a lot of the older dudes that were placed in charge. And coming from like a background where I had an I don't care attitude to now actually caring. So now I'm just like trying to pick stuff up, learning from everybody, trying to learn as much as I can and be better, you know?
What do you think changed from having that I don't care attitude that you mentioned to the attitude that you currently have transitioning into a I really care a lot attitude?
I know consequences is a big part of it, you know. I didn't like being in prison. I hated it, you know, being away from my family and just being told what to do, you know. That's all it was. It's just you're not able to do what you want to do when you want to do it. You know, you're always told what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in prison. So I started to like really get in touch with myself and see who I really was and what I really wanted to do in life. And when I made my decision to start caring, I didn't know like, okay, yeah, I care now, but where do I start? What do I do? You know? So, I mean, I just started taking classes and that put me in a place where I was around individuals that had purpose with their life. And I just started learning off them, and then it got me to firefighting where I'm around individuals that love what they do. And that's who I'm around now. You know, I mean, look, I'm meeting you guys and this is just more people, you know, to just learn from and expand my reality with, you know.
Absolutely. Sounds like you've been doing a lot of work on yourself to get more and more in touch with yourself. And that's really inspiring. Part of doing that work is your clear commitment to continuing your growth as a firefighter now that you're no longer incarcerated. And what made you want to continue working as a firefighter once you got out of prison?
I didn't have nothing else. You know, I went in with basically nothing. And it's something that I invested a year in. And I was like, you know what? Let me put that year of all this hard work that I did out here and let me put it to use, you know. And the opportunity was there when I got out, thanks to the program I got into, and things just started aligning. And that's where I basically figured, like, let me just continue to grow and let me just continue to learn and try to make some out of it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And you just mentioned a program you went through. Is that the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program?
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit more about what the program is?
It's basically for individuals who are incarcerated that got out and want to get into the fire service. At that time, it was a lot harder for individuals to do that. There wasn't that many opportunities. And this provided opportunity for myself and others who got into the fire service and were out there actually working on fires now. And there's a lot of great dudes in there that have been in the same shoes that I was in and that came out and had that same goal, that same passion, and made it happen. As like I said, that put me around a lot of great individuals and we all just learned from each other and made it happen, you know?
Yeah, wow. Thanks for sharing a little bit about what they provide. And it's so awesome to learn about their program. Thank you. And something that we haven't really gone into yet is the pandemic. And I'm wondering how things in your personal life and with your work life changed with the pandemic.
It was kind of like dreadful being in camp and incarcerated because visits were totally shut down, you know? So I think I went like almost a year without seeing my wife. And that's coming from us almost seeing each other every weekend. She would go visit me, you know? So that's something that was kind of hard, you know? All we knew is what we seen on the news and what our families told us over the phones, you know? So we just wanted it to be over already so we could get back to the normalcy that we knew, which were visits and all that stuff. And we were still expected to go out there and give our best, fight and fire, you know? But you need your family time also, you know? I think that's a part of your fulfillment in life. But I got through it, and I know a lot of them dudes, we all got through it together, you know?
Yeah, it just makes so much sense that in your heart, you'd be focusing on your family during the pandemic, especially given that you couldn't see them. I'm so glad that you're able to all be together now. And I'm wondering if you can share with me what the working conditions were like this summer while you were out on the front lines fighting fires during the pandemic with the heavy impact that this past fire season had in California.
It was bad. You had to push yourself and be strong. You know, every person out there has a will, you know, and I think they push themselves. And that's why I tip my hat off to everybody out there. You know, they work hard. They do it for, you know, for California.
Wow. That's a really powerful statement. They do it for California. It makes me wonder what California is doing for you all out on the front lines. It sounds like you take a lot of pride in your work, and I'm wondering if you can describe a moment from when you've been out firefighting that you're particularly proud of.
I think just not giving up despite the obstacles that I had, just pushing through them. You know, there was times I did want to give up. I did want to just like, man, let me just look for another career. Or let me just look for something else to do. And it's a rewarding feeling now just knowing that I could look back and be like, man, I remember I wanted to give up that day, or I remember I was pretty much done, you know, and that just builds up my little strength for the next obstacle that comes because I know what I've got through already and I'm going to just keep pushing through whatever else comes my way, you know?
That's beautiful that you're committed to sticking with this work and being of service to your community. Part of that commitment is also coming on the show today and sharing your story. So why for you is it important to share your story?
I mean, there's a lot of different reasons, but I just want people to know that there is light at the end of the tunnel, you know, despite whatever your background is. Anybody with the same background as me or anybody that's just been through stuff, you know, that just to not give up in life and just to keep pushing and keep learning, keep trying, you know, keep persevering. It's always going to get better, you know.
Absolutely. And what messages would you like to leave for future firefighters, especially ones who've been incarcerated and working in the fire camps like you did? And maybe as a follow-up to that, what message would you like to leave to your younger self if you could?
Well, for the guys that were in camp that I knew that probably wanted to do this, but they didn't know how, there is a way. And if I can lend a helping hand or some guidance, you know, I'm more than happy to do it. And not only myself, I also know my superiors are more than happy to do it also. And it's just like a community, you know, helping each other out, trying to get better and in turn help everybody else out. To my younger self, I would just tell them like, man, what were you thinking? You know, but I'm honestly glad where I'm at today. I know sometimes I don't want to be regretful, you know, for some of the bad things I've done, but I am remorseful. But I know that I am where I am today, and I'm happy, and I know this ain't the end of the story for me. You know, all I could do is make better decisions now and make a better future for myself, my family, and hopefully my community.
We as Californians are lucky to have someone like Gabriel out on the front lines. He cares so deeply for his work, and it's beyond absurd that he could have been denied these opportunities just because he was incarcerated.
Not only does Gabriel have the skills from his time working in the fire camps, but he understands the power of what he does. It's quite inspiring that he so clearly found his calling.
And like so many of our essential workers, it is a calling to serve others. We will continue celebrating and supporting these firefighters rather than preventing them from serving our communities. When we get back from the break, we'll have a roundtable conversation with Jamie Lowe and Brandon Smith.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
I often get asked why I'm such a big fan of wrestling. And it's all thanks to my grandma. Growing up, we would watch matches together, and that bond turned me into a lifelong fan. Hi, I'm Freddie Prinze Jr., and on my podcast, Wrestling with Freddie, we know how important it is to have the right teammate, because things can get pretty tricky quick. So, when things get complicated and you need help, State Farm gives you options. They show you what's possible for ensuring what matters to you. One of the things that matters to me? Sharing memories and revisiting wrestling's greatest moments. And with State Farm's support of the My Cultura Podcast Network, I get to do just that. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Listen to new episodes of your favorite My Cultura shows, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Jamie and Brandon, thank you so much for being here with us on Essential Voices today. It's a true honor to be chatting with you both, and I'm really, really looking forward to diving into Gabriel's story and hearing your thoughts. So to kick us off, Brandon, what are your initial reactions to what Gabriel shared with us?
So when I listen to Gabriel, I feel hope. I feel excitement. I feel more of a possibility. A lot of folks think that formerly incarcerated people don't deserve to do this work, shouldn't do this work. And I think just listening to Gabriel right now just proves that formerly incarcerated people deserve the opportunity to go do this work. And people are in it for, quote unquote, like the right reasons. You know, he speaks about how he wants to give back to the community. He speaks on how he wants to help bring more people into the fold. And he speaks about how he's going to help like himself and his family. That's what I'm talking about. That's what we're talking about. There is a solution to our challenges, and Gabriel is one of them.
Really beautifully said, Brandon, and I totally agree. I was really moved by Gabriel's heart of service to his community, which this has been a beautiful common theme that we've seen in the Essential Voices we've spoken to this season. Gabriel shares his heart of service and that spirit, so it was really special for me to see this thread continue through his story. Thanks, Brandon. And Jamie, what about you? What are your initial thoughts?
Oh, man, I had so many initial thoughts. It was really moving to hear him talk, first off. But I think listening to him talk about wanting to get an EMT triggered, you know, my feelings of how frustrating it is that it's not easier for formerly incarcerated firefighters, and that there are, even with legislation passed, that there are real barriers. And I'm heartened by his optimism, but I also, you know, I feel like frustrated on behalf of his future self, knowing like what a lot of people have been going through with AB 2147, which is the bill. I think that, you know, when he said, there was one phrase that I wrote down because it struck me, that he said that they do it for California. That is so meaningful to me, because I feel like the next level is missing, which is that California is not doing it for them. That there's like this lack of reciprocation and acknowledgement. And it's not even individual Californians, because the women that I interviewed for the book all spoke to people who would put up signs that were thanking them for what they were doing, for saving their homes, and that that meant so much to them every time they saw them. But that there are, you know, the fact that formerly incarcerated firefighters have such a hard time finding work in the field on the very base level is problematic. But then on a broader level, just that there's so little support on reentry for everyone who's formerly incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, I don't know, it made me feel like it was one of the reasons I was so interested in writing about the programs, is that there is this deep pride in what the crews are doing who are incarcerated, which is that they are doing it to protect the state, but that also there isn't enough that the state is giving them back.
What you're saying was something that really struck me as well from my conversation with Gabriel about him and his fellow firefighting comrades doing it for California, which begged that question that you're bringing up about how there isn't enough that the state is giving back to incarcerated laborers. Could you expand a bit on this complicated history, particularly California's relationship to incarcerated labor? How did this relationship begin, and how does the state rely on incarcerated firefighters?
Sure. I mean, I would refer everyone to Lillian Hernandez's book, City of Inmates, which is one of the best books written about kind of the building of the state and how it really utilized incarceration, and that people were essentially jailed on vagrancy laws and then auctioned off to plow fields, to work, to build roads. Sunset Boulevard was laid that way. The PCH was laid with incarcerated people from San Quentin, essentially work that was super dangerous and more dangerous than what a lot of people who were in very, very strong unions were unwilling to do. In 1946, when a lot of men were shipped off to World War II, the fire camps took over what the road crews, the areas that the road crews were living, and they became responsible for like being wildland firefighters for the state. And the first Governor Brown essentially thought it was so effective that he, I think, had this at the time ideal vision of it as a rehabilitation, and that it was a way for having an incarceration method that involved being outside and having work that was meaningful was maybe what he was thinking. Mm. And so from 46 on, you know, there were thousands of people. There are juvenile camps still, and they worked the lines along with Cal Fire, municipal crews, forestry crews, and they've been out there saving the state from fire. And as mega fires have taken over, and as our climate catastrophe has gotten worse, they're on the front lines, you know, risking their lives.
Thanks so much for providing that context. And it really goes to show that it's a system that has failed, which prevents or does not guarantee work to incarcerated folks, keeping families and communities safe from wildfires upon reentry after everything they've dedicated to California through their service. Brandon, anything to add there?
Yeah. Thank you for that, Jamie, because I think a lot of people don't understand where that comes from. First and foremost, let me say this. We as Americans have a problem utilizing incarcerated people as laborers, period. And it goes back, you know, there's always a lot of conversation. Is this slavery, yada, yada, yada? I liken it more to indentured servitude because I made a choice. But these folks go out here and they get trained on this work. They go out here and have lived experience in this work. But when they come home, they can't utilize these experiences or these skill sets. You know, it's somewhat like indentured servitude to me. In addition to that, what's very interesting is pre-COVID, incarcerated firefighters made up to 30% of the firefighting force. Currently, right now in California, there are 35 fire camps and training centers, right? Like over 2,000 people a year go through this system. Pre-COVID, we're talking about somewhere around 9,000, but 2,000 people every year go through this system and they help out the state. A lot of folks think that this work is just in firefighting, but there are a couple of different other avenues as well. Firefighting administration. Some people are in camp who, like, if you were to call a fire station and say, hey, oh, this is this fire station, it's probably someone who's incarcerated. Cooks, custodians, finance folks, logistics, people in the warehouse, mechanics. Also, while I was incarcerated in fire camp, we met whatever labor need the state had, fire or not. We would go do search and rescue. I used to work at water treatment plants. So I was cleaning water for the city of Hemet. We were building golf courses. We were building baseball fields. We were doing beautification projects. Like anything that the state needed, we fill those needs. And the challenge that I have is if we were good enough to do this work while incarcerated, we should be able to go hop into these careers within or these sectors once we come home. And that's real rehabilitation.
Yeah. You know, you're painting a picture of a vast variety of services that folks in the fire camps provide besides fighting fires. And for folks who are not incarcerated, it would seem that we often take for granted that parks are kept maintained and that we have clean water to drink without giving thanks to the folks who are ensuring these services run smoothly. You just described so many different responsibilities that you had while you were working in the camps, and it leads me to a question for you, Brandon, because you've worked in the camps and you've brought expertise with you since you're no longer incarcerated as you continue your work as a firefighter. So could you talk about the program that you created, the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program, which is the program that Gabriel went through, and share what the program is, why it was started, and how you support folks who come through the program?
Yeah, thank you. So first and foremost, FFRP is here under the belief that what we do, the state of California should already be doing itself as a government agency. But FFRP, the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program, we're a nonprofit organization that helps the people who are currently and formerly incarcerated in California's fire camps transition into family-winning employment within this sector. How we do that is a couple of different ways. First, we go to all 35 fire camps and training centers. There's still a public knowledge situation, right? Like when you think about how Black folks, African-Americans celebrate Juneteenth because, you know, we were freed, but people didn't know that information. There is still something similar like that going on within the camp system. Incarcerated people still don't believe that they can transition into the situation. But once they come home, we provide them with a myriad of supports. Let's go get you some social workers. Let's go get you some housing. Let's go help you with job prep. Let's go recertify you so that I can get you a credential that is actually accepted within the space. Let's go help you to go network within the firefighting world and go from there. We also, in the meantime, operate our own private firefighting crews. So we have folks that go, you heard Perez talk about going to the Caldor fire. And we also help out homeowners and homeowner associations. So we feel like we meet at like a very unique intersection of environmental and criminal justice and workforce development challenges. My personal get down is I have a lived experience in this space. So I was locked up straight up. In 2012, I got sent to Batista Conservation Camp. I paroled home and it was hard. It was extremely hard. I spent almost 2 years. I used to go to fire stations. I was turning in applications. I just didn't know how to hop into that world. One day I got a shot. Shout out to Black women, Chief Betty Ash. She was the chief of the U.S. Forest Service out in Big Bear, California. And she gave me a shot one day. And when she gave me a shot, lo and behold, what always happens, I was working professionally, me and my co-founder, Royal Ramey, we were working professionally, and we go look to the right. And who was there? The folks who are currently incarcerated, our old crews, Batista, crew one and crew two, the folks we were just on the cruise with 2 years ago. And it's like, that's their first time seeing somebody that looks like us in this space. And then that's a reminder to us that, like, bro, I can't go out here and just win by myself and move forward. Like, I have to give back because I remember so many people who wanted to thrive in this space. And so here we are today. So we operate training programs. We work with employers like Cal Fire, private agencies, county agencies, governments. And we work with homeowners to do immediate fire prevention work, to go put some money in our participants' pockets. We have social workers to go deal with reentry because, Jamie, you're right, reentry is hard as hell. All y'all are right, reentry is hard. And what we're trying to do is prove to folks that, number one, formerly incarcerated people deserve the opportunity. Number two, there's such a labor shortage that these people deserve opportunities to go move forward. And like, we're just doing it. And lastly, you know, I love to talk about this so I can ramble all day. But like, we believe that this is something that the state of California should be doing itself. But you know what? We as people, as a community, are doing it ourselves.
Thank you so much for sharing about what you do at FFRP. It's incredible the work you're doing to support folks who want to continue firefighting. And you share Gabriel's heart of service. And I also want to say I'm really struck by the story you shared of firefighting once you were no longer incarcerated and turning around and realizing you were working shoulder to shoulder with folks who you'd been working with at the camps. Thank you so much for sharing that.
We'll be right back after this break.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
I love sharing positive tips with my listeners on everything from health challenges to relationship troubles. Because life happens, baby, but you got this. Hi there. I'm Honey German, and I know we can all use some positive energy these days. That's why I make sure to empower my community, because a bit of motivation and support can go a long way. And luckily, we have State Farm to support us. Like when you talk to a State Farm agent to choose the coverage you need, and they have the options to protect the things you value most. It's the perfect positive tip you need. State Farm is also a big supporter of the My Cultura podcast network, where we as podcast hosts get to share our experiences and stories. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Listen to new episodes of your favorite My Cultura shows wherever you listen to podcasts.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Welcome back to Essential Voices.
And turning it over to you, Jamie, I want to talk about the book that you wrote, Breathing Fire. Why did you want to investigate these stories from women fighting fires while incarcerated? And what were some of your goals in sharing the book with the world?
Yeah, I write all different kinds of things. I don't actually have a beat, which is not helpful for my career, but keeps me actually interested in wanting to continue writing. And I'm constantly looking for stories. And there was a 496 word story in the front page of the California section of the LA Times. And I grew up in LA and I was home. And it was about Shauna Lynn Jones, who was a female incarcerated firefighter, who the article is about how she died fighting a fire in the Santa Monica Hills. And, you know, I was just really struck by two things from the article. And one was, like I said, I grew up in LA. you know, I know those hills. I know California really well. I was born in Oakland. No one had ever told me about the camps. I didn't know about fire camps. I didn't know about the history of the fire. And I was embarrassed for myself. And then also I was like, who else doesn't know? Because I bet a lot of people don't know about this. And the second part of it was that Shauna Lynn Jones was basically reduced to this sentence or two sentence description of her crime and the fact that she was from Lancaster. And I felt like I needed to know more about her. You know, I wanted to know who she was before she was incarcerated. I wanted to know what it was like for her in camp. I wanted to know what her family was like. I just wanted to know more about her. And so I started there and I ended up writing an article that was about her death, but then also about the camps. And after the article came out, a lot of people responded to it. And I thought that one of the things that I felt like is missing is that you don't hear about actual lived experiences from women who have gone through the system. And so I really wanted to go back to the interviews I did because I had talked with about 30 to 40 women who were incarcerated firefighters when I was doing the original reporting. And I wanted to sort of narrow it down to 5 to 7 women and talk about their lives before they were incarcerated, what it was like to go through the system from being processed in jail to then going to state, if they went to state, to then, you know, what it was like when they were firefighters, what it was like to be a firefighter who was also incarcerated, because there's a level of carrying stress and trauma that being a civilian firefighter, I think that you don't have. And then I wanted to talk about what their lives were like upon release, which, as we've touched on a little bit, for varying degrees, you know, there was one woman that I profiled who, you know, she ended up being a hotshot and she's on her, I think she's now going to try and apply for her third season as a helitech on a crew. And, you know, there was another woman who really wanted to become a firefighter, but she had 2 kids she had to sort of be with. She had to go to school again. She had to take all the tests again. She had to juggle 2 jobs, go to, you know, be on the bus back and forth to try and do it. And she had no support. And so there were varying degrees of reentry that I just felt like it was really important to kind of talk about what the experience of the fire camps meant and then how they themselves felt about it. And I wanted to just hear from them.
Are there aspects of what Gabriel spoke to us about that either were or were not present with the women that you interviewed for Breathing Fire? And if there were similarities and differences, could you share some of them with us?
You know, I think everyone, like in most cases, have really different experiences and different really sort of life experiences. I think what he experienced, like the one specific that I can attest to, is that he went through FFRP and he was able to actually do, I feel like he was able to succeed at connecting with a job. And I think that the women who I talked with, you know, when they were released, they actually didn't have a connection with someone. And there wasn't an immediate sort of knowledge base, you know, like what was talked about in terms of just disseminating information about ways that you can work. I think a lot of the women assumed that they couldn't. And because it's so hard, because you get rejected from almost every job you apply for anyway, whether it's like firefighting or not. And then the firefighting world, as you mentioned already, is this incredibly exclusive club that is, you know, there are known sort of, and I'm going to make a kind of bold statement, but it's like a known racist and misogynistic enterprise. And it's something that, imagine being formerly incarcerated and trying to enter into this incredibly exclusive world. So I think that that connection that he could be part of that program is really different than anyone that I interviewed, and that it is absolutely something that seems like the state should be doing, that that immediately upon, like, you know, one of the women that I talked with, Selena, she was on three seasons, maybe. She was a Sawyer. She was like amazing. And she was like, yeah, I got dropped off at a bus station with $200. Like, it was my gate fee. And I had called someone to get me and I went back to MacArthur Park because I didn't know what else to do. I just was like, this is it, I guess. And then she ended up working, I think, at like a donut factory. But if somebody had actually talked to her and was like, look at what you can do, look at the money you can make, look at how you can, like, she might have been interested. And no one's having those conversations because there's such a disconnect. And I do think that the word, you know, CDCR, the last word is rehabilitation. And I think like every woman that I interviewed always refers to the organization as CDC. And I think that's because rehabilitation isn't really part of it. When you're released, it continues. You have to continue. You have to care for people. You have to make sure that you have support, jobs, you know, mental health services, groups for addiction, like anything that's necessary to not return to the system. So that was one major thing that seemed really different.
If I can hop in real quick, because that's real. So first of all, when you look at the firefighting population within California, you're going to see very clear characteristics of who these people are. They are men. They look a certain way. They come from certain communities, right? And if you don't come from that background, it's very, very hard to go transition into the space, regardless of who you are. You know, say it again. I'm from Altadena, California. The mountains are in my backyard. I never knew about this career until I was incarcerated. When we have thousands and thousands of underrepresented people or marginalized communities who can go thrive in these spaces, I always feel for the plight of women. I think of one of my good friends. Her name is Angela. And I know Angela won't be mad about me speaking about her. But Angela had so many challenges when she came home professionally because she was at an all-male fire engine. And folks couldn't understand what that looked like. In firefighting, we're out there doing 16 or 24 hour shifts. They couldn't understand how she was going to use the bathroom. They didn't understand, you know, the physicality of who she was. And she had a daughter and all kind of stuff. Like, you know, and it's like, bro, like y'all stop joking about her. Like, she's a person, she's a woman, and she's actually out here out hiking most of y'all. But there's all these biases that people have, like, oh, she's a woman, she can't be as fit as us and all this kind of stuff. And I think that goes to show the biases within the fire service and how organizations like FFRP and other organizations are trying to combat that. Because when you look at the majority of professional firefighters, it's white men. And then when you look at the majority of firefighters who are people who are incarcerated, they're going to be people of color and they're going to be women. That brings back up the slavery conversation that everyone always brings, or the enslavement of people, because it's very this overseer minority group presence. And like, that's fucked up. You know, these folks deserve opportunities when they come home. They just don't know how to tackle these, how to address these. You know, I'm lucky when I came home, I had a child, I had a daughter, but like, I can only imagine if I was like my wife, if I was a mom, childcare issues, all those kind of things. Like there are so many things that are built up into this. And I just look at it like, come on, you know, Governor Newsom, I respect you, Governor Newsom. And all these politicians, they go out here every year and they say, hey, we have a shortage of firefighters. We need more firefighters. Well, why don't you go to these communities that you haven't reached out to? Why don't you figure out a way to get more women? Why don't you figure out how to go get more Black and brown folks? Go to Crenshaw High School, go to John Muir High School, go get people who are at threat of incarceration, right? We as Californians have a challenge dealing with young people in foster care, transitional age youth. Like, let's go find opportunities there, because this career has the opportunity to be life-changing, especially in a world where fire season is continually getting worse and worse and worse. I don't want to date this podcast, but this is early 2022. And there's already been multiple wildfires in California already. Mm-hmm. We used to talk about this thing called fire season, but it's fire year. And so I'm talking about taking proactive steps to go out here and deal with it. But that's where I'm at.
I just had one thing to add, which was about kind of taking the proactive step about doing more to broaden the field. You know, that was another really interesting part of this that I felt like when I wanted to write about it was that a lot of the foremen and captains would point to these female crews and they'd be like, they cut line better than men. They're more precise. They do it faster. They're like really strong at what they do. They know how to cut containment line. They know when they're out on a fire, they do it. And you had this situation where women were thriving in a career while incarcerated somehow that in the free world cannot figure out how to utilize women. There's got to be a way, like if female crews work well, why can't they work well not incarcerated? Like what is the disconnect here?
What an important question that you're posing. And you may have answered it, at least in part, when you talk about misogyny and racism. And while folks are out here working to dismantle these systems of oppression that have kept marginalized and minoritized folks, especially from communities of color, from having the same opportunities as white folks or cis male folks, what remains clear is that these systems of oppression still influence who's getting what kinds of opportunities. And I'm, for one, grateful to know that FFRP is out here working to dismantle these systems of oppression and that folks like you both are in the mix of creating moments of future building and creating the futures that we want to live in. And so being here in this conversation with you both, you're both pointing towards a lot of work that needs to be done to exist within these futures, but you're also inspiring hope that folks can create change.
We'll be right back after this break.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
I love sharing positive tips with my listeners on everything from health challenges to relationship troubles. Because life happens, baby, but you got this. Hi there, I'm Honey German, and I know we can all use some positive energy these days. That's why I make sure to empower my community, because a bit of motivation and support can go a long way. And luckily, we have State Farm to support us. Like when you talk to a State Farm agent to choose the coverage you need, and they have the options to protect the things you value most. It's the perfect positive tip you need. State Farm is also a big supporter of the My Cultura podcast network, where we as podcast hosts get to share our experiences and stories. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Listen to new episodes of your favorite My Cultura shows wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Essential Voices.
I just want to backtrack for a moment because something you said, Brandon, about California and it no longer being fire season, but fire year, really struck me. All three of us are calling in today from California, and we saw what the impact of 2021's fire season had on the state. Even just last month, I'm here in the Bay Area, and we were getting smoke from the Big Sur fires, and it wasn't even the summer. We heard from Gabriel that folks in the fire camps are out working on these huge California wildfires. So can you expand on the role that incarcerated firefighters play during these really heavy fire seasons in California that at this point just keep getting heavier?
Yeah. So incarcerated people operate on what they call hand crews. Okay. A hand crew is a group of 20 people whose sole responsibility is to go out here and create fire breaks. And what fire breaks mean is, like, imagine you have a yard and I have a lawnmower. I'm the fire crew. So I'm the lawnmower. Half of your lawn is on fire. I'm going to mow half of the lawn so that the other half doesn't hop on fire. Right. That's what we do, for lack of a better term. Hand crews are the physical labor portion of this work. What's interesting is that while incarcerated, these folks, the majority of the work that they do is, all the work that they do is on a hand crew. And so Cal Fire, the state of California, heavily relies on incarcerated people to be on these hand crews, a very, very crucial piece of this work, which happens to be the most dangerous because sadly, that's the group that's not always prepared with water. So like when I was going out in the forest, like I wouldn't have like a water hose. Sometimes I would, but like I wouldn't. I had a chainsaw and I was just trying to cut down this tree so this tree wouldn't catch on fire to send it to the next piece. What also happens during that time is that type of work is extremely dangerous. Incarcerated people pass at equally, or I would argue higher rates than non-incarcerated people do in this work. You're normally in a situation of 15 to 20 incarcerated people to one supervisor, whereas when you do this work professionally, you have one supervisor to five people. So it causes for a very dangerous situation.
To piggyback on that, obviously there needs to be major changes in how we address fire, how we manage fire, how we work with fire, and who works with fire. It, you know, remains this thing that I kept realizing when I was doing the reporting, which was like, and that actually is, this is a tangent, but you know, the people responsible for the major fires are the utility companies, which are these privately owned companies that are doing like white collar crime. They never do time. They pay these enormous fines, but nothing close to the billions of damages that they cause. And what the fires that they cause from not having, you know, they have faulty lines, they don't prepare people, they don't, you know, tell, like the wind is up and they don't do the emergency shutoffs, which they should be doing. And the people who are cleaning up their mess are, like you described, they are crews made up of Black and brown people, low-income people, people who are incarcerated, who are in the system because they're not, you know, part of this private white collar enterprise. And that was something in the course of reporting that I came to realize and was just, it's just deeply frustrating and not optimistic. But I hope that there's a way that we can shift from the fire crews being part of the prison system.
Gosh, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, okay, so I had a conversation once with a government agency that contracts out these crews of people who are incarcerated. They pay a rate of $250 a day for 20 people. Right? So they pay $250 for a 20-person crew for 8 hours. That's how much these folks are like maximized on. Because that don't even fit minimum wage salaries at all. You know, if you do 20 people at 8 hours at $15 an hour, there's some number there. But these government agencies are only paying $250 for the whole day for all of them. It's so crazy how much these folks are maximized on. It's interesting when the pandemic hit the state of California, Governor Newsom decided to let go of what they consider to be low-level offenders. These folks who are low-level offenders are the people who are within the fire camp program. You have people on camera saying, why would the governor let go of these people? Because we need more firefighters. What? This is ass backwards. Are you arguing to me right now that we should keep people locked up because we need more people to go be firefighters in this space? Right.
And not the first time that was argued either. That was argued before the pandemic when Kamala Harris was
Yes.
She had the same argument.
You know, like that's a fucked up argument. Excuse my language, but like you want to. And OK, we have a wildfire problem. How do we solve it? Lock people up. What? I thought we was California. I thought we was the progressives out here.
Mm-mm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's so ridiculous. And I think what it is folks keep trying to put band-aids over this problem or this challenge, or like nobody knows how to solve this problem or this challenge. And like, that's why FFRP is out here. That's why Jamie is doing her work, because we're showing that there are alternate ways to create a solution to this problem, like, or to this challenge. Like, it's not locking people up. Let's prevent young people from being locked up. Let's prevent foster youth, transitional age youth from being locked up. Let's prevent people with substance abuse issues from being locked up. Let's figure out ways that these people can win and address this challenge.
To piggyback on that, I think that the FIRE program, you know, and this was true in Gabriel's story, and from what I'm hearing you say a little bit, Brandon, and from everyone I interviewed, there were elements of it that were incredibly positive and that were rewarding. And I was so interested in hearing those parts of it. And I think they give this as an alternative, like make this a program. You know, the CDCR says that they save the state something like $100 million a year in the fact that they have incarcerated firefighters. The state of California for 2 years running has a budget surplus, and give that money to the people doing the work, give jobs, make these programs something that is meaningful, that involves social services, that involves, you know, let's do something positive. And I think that's one of the reasons the camps were so interesting to me, is that they had something that felt good to them, even though there were so many parts that were just like completely wrong and didn't make any sense. And there was just a bureaucracy to it that could be fixed, that they could be used as an example. And somehow it just is so entrenched, and we haven't quite been able to shift. But I believe that we can, and I believe it's actually possible.
Real quick, Jamie, being in fire camp saved my life. If I had said no to fire camp and just been in a dorm or a cell, who knows? You know, I definitely wouldn't be here in this situation right now. We wouldn't have FFRP. Like, there was a blessing, but did I get maxed out? Oh, I got maxed out. Did I get put in some unsafe situations? I definitely got put in some unsafe situations. Was there any support when I came home for me to transition into this space, even though I wanted to? No. There's a way that this can be beneficial to the people that are incarcerated within this space, and it's not, because what y'all doing is maxing us out.
You know, Brandon, what you're talking about circles back to what you said at the very beginning when you were sharing initial thoughts about Gabriel's story, which you said gives you hope even in moments that don't feel super hopeful. So as we wrap up our conversation today, you're bringing us back to that hope, and there's momentum as well. So I'm curious how you create those moments of joy and hope for your community, for FFRP, and for yourself. And also, how can the community at large support the work that you're doing?
So I'll say internally as a program, we try to build up folks' hope and self-esteem again, right? Because once you come home, you think it's over. So you know what? When you come to us, we're going to recertify you. We're going to give you all those classes. And when you're in these classes are easy because you've been doing this work for the last 3 to 5 years. So you already know what this is about. We're going to provide you paid on-the-job training. So when one homeowners association pays us to go do fire prevention work, then we'll pay you $17.50 an hour to put money in your pocket so that you can start thriving and moving forward. It's us, you know, FFRP having our professional uniforms and what we call our class Bs. And so, you know, you get hired by us and then you go get the badge and the uniform, or you go work for the U.S. Forest Service or Cal Fire, and you go do all that work. It's becoming like a pillar of your own community or that kind of get down. And that's what we talk about. What we try to do is instill hope and possibility for people. Like, if you love this while you were doing it locked up, like, you can do it when you come home. And this can be a viable way of life for you. You know, sadly, wildfires are going to continue to increase in their frequency and severity. So it's only going to get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. FFRP is just here to help and support anyone in that area.
Absolutely amazing, Brandon. Thank you so much for sharing that and for letting your community know and see by example what you're doing, and that you're creating futures where firefighting can be a viable option once folks are no longer incarcerated. And for you, Jamie, bringing it full circle to what we started off on, how does California support its formerly incarcerated firefighters in a real way, just like the firefighters are doing it and supporting and serving California?
I guess on a very broad note, I would say one would be to de-radicalize the word abolition and to use it as a model that the way that our prisons and jails are operating right now is unacceptable, and that the fact that these fire camps are sort of the only livable alternative and these that's a motivating factor to get there is because you're in such inhumane conditions that you kind of have to put yourself in these, you know, sometimes deadly situations. I think that's one place to start, is we have to do extreme reform in prisons and jails and in basically the entire criminal justice scenario, because, you know, one problem is just how many people are incarcerated. One of the things Brandon was talking about was being out in the environment. There are tons of studies that talk about how dealing with PTSD, like being out in nature, is like actually something that is restorative when you're dealing with PTSD, when you're dealing with having to kind of go through a lot of emotional stuff. And that, I think, is something that could actually be employed as true rehabilitation, which I think needs a reexamination. I think we really need to actually look at ourselves and what we've accepted as treatment for humanity and people. Because I think we are in a situation where it's unacceptable.
I think this is a really powerful place for us to wrap up our conversation today. But I just want to say that I'm totally, totally blown away by both of you and by this conversation. You're both incredible storytellers and shared so much wisdom with us today. I'm really grateful for your time and to have shared space with you. It was very generative for me to hear about the work that needs to be done. And if there's any way that we can help out, the team here at Essential Voices stands behind you to support you in any way possible. Thank you both so much.
Right, let's do it.
Let's do it.
That's right.
I can't shake the powerful image that Brandon shared of that moment that he was out firefighting while no longer incarcerated, and he looked over his shoulder and saw folks he'd been fighting fires with from the fire camps working alongside of him. And I was so appreciative to both Jamie and Brandon for cluing listeners into the history of the state using incarcerated labor to essentially fill the gaps when the government doesn't want to pay folks what they should be earning to do these jobs.
You know, I mean, to be honest, Amar, I hate to admit it. Like Jamie, before she started her reporting on this, I didn't know the intricacies of this inherently exploitative system. It really emphasizes something we already know, right? That there's so much history that gets erased when it doesn't look pretty. Mm. And it's with a lot of pride that our team at Essential Voices humbly hopes to reclaim a bit of this ugly history through the stories that we share today. We need to hold the folks who keep us safe from these ravaging fires close to our hearts, because they're out there risking their lives, breathing in the smoke, and we're just left to sift through the ash. So join us over the next 2 weeks in a two-part series where we'll explore the impact of COVID-19 on essential worker Anthony Almojeda, an emergency medical responder in New York City, and then have a roundtable discussion with grief expert, psychotherapist, and host of the podcast Hereafter, Megan Devine. We'll be back next week.
Essential Voices with Wilmer Valderrama is produced by me, MR Raquel, Allison Shano, and Kevin Rutkowski, with production support from associate producer Lillian Holman, executive producers Wilmer Valderrama, Adam Reynolds, Leo Clem, and Aaron Hilliard. This episode was edited by MR Raquel, Sean Tracy, and Justin Cho, and features original music by Will Rizzotti. Special thanks to this week's Essential Voice, Gabriel Perez, and to our thought leaders Jamie Lowe and Brandon Smith. Additional thanks to Solomon Moreno-Rosa, Carissa Speth, and Gracie Goodman. This is a Clamor and WV Entertainment production in partnership with iHeartRadio's My Cultura podcast network. For more podcasts from iHeart, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Tengo diabetes.
Yo, asma. Estamos en riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica.
19 años o más con afecciones crónicas como asma, diabetes, EPOC o enfermedad cardíaca, o tienes 65 años o más, estás en mayor riesgo de contraer la neumonía neumocócica. Pregunta a tu médico o farmacéutico sobre Prevnar 20, una vacuna de Pfizer que puede ayudar a proteger contra la neumonía neumocócica con una sola dosis. Aunque te hayas vacunado previamente con otras vacunas contra la neumonía, Prevnar 20 puede ayudar a proveer protección adicional. Prevnar 20 está aprobada para adultos para ayudar a prevenir infecciones de 20 cepas de la bacteria que causa la neumonía neumocócica. La aprobación continua puede depender de un estudio de apoyo. No uses Prevnar 20 si has tenido una reacción alérgica grave a la vacuna o a sus componentes. Los adultos con sistemas inmunitarios debilitados pueden tener una respuesta reducida a la vacuna. Los efectos secundarios incluyen dolor e hinchazón en el área de la inyección, fatiga, dolor de cabeza, dolor muscular y en las coyunturas. Para obtener la información para la prescripción completa, llama al 1-855-213-213 138 o visita prevnar20enespañol.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.